Hello, and welcome to the Future Virtual Economies podcast. This is our inaugural episode in what will hopefully turn out to be a small series of informative chats about recent developments in the world of virtual economies in and around video games, and some freeform speculation about what the future will hold for not only games, but also the broader metaverse. Our focus here will not be so much on technologies such as crypto games, network analytics, the Web3, NFTs, cross-reality marketplaces, or cryptocurrencies, but rather the interface in between these technologies and society. The games have become the testbed and seed of innovation for these new ideas and technologies is not a coincidence. The games industry is incredibly innovative, and the sector has been the first adopters of new ideas around technology and monetization for more than two decades. However, what is often missing in our rush to experiment with new technologies is consideration about the broader implications of these, not at least the impact on the players and the creators. This is what we will focus on here. I am Anders Draken from the University of Southern Denmark and will be hosting today's episode along with Catherine Flick, researcher at De Montfort University and a renowned games ethicist and expert in the ethical and societal and climate-related implications of new technologies such as NFTs. Catherine has become the go-to person for media to understand the ethical questions that new technologies raise. Also with me is David Sindel, a researcher at the University of York, and the most published author worldwide on in-game monetization systems. He is advising governments worldwide on regulating the games market and working hard to provide data and facts to guide regulation so we avoid policymakers enacting new policies without having a good basis for making decisions. He's also the first academic to dive into the world of crypto gaming. And finally, we have Sebastian Dieseting from Imperial College, one of the most prolific and cited academics worldwide on game design and user experience, with a track record of helping companies develop responsible and sustainable designs in games and beyond. He's also an expert in gamification and design in engineering and a renowned educator. What a team! So, today we will be focusing on the broader future of virtual economies. But I thought it might be interesting to start us out with trying to define what is the thing that we are actually talking about here. What are virtual economies, and I guess what do they look like right now? Sebastian, do you wanna start us out?
Sure. As any good academic, of course, I did some paper shuffling and know that nothing is new because virtual economies already is an established term. They have a more than 20, 30-year history by whatever you count. So there is this lovely book by Willy Leon Goethe and Edward Castronova that came out now 8 years ago with the title Virtual Economies. And if you open it up, there on page two, they say, virtual economy is an economy that is based on scarce digital resources, right? So this uses the basic economic ideas that economics is about decision making when faced with scarce resources, and the characteristic quality of virtual economies rather than real world economies is that we're talking about digital resources. And not just any digital resource, but some that are scarce, right? So anybody right now in the Web3 or NFT mind sphere will be familiar with the idea of scarcity as something that can produce value. And this is something that we've seen in virtual economies, starting with QQ's KuCoin in 2002 or Second Life or many of the early MMOs, which had virtual goods, you know, swords, gold, what have you, but they were not available in abundance. They were scarce. They were made scarce by their developers. You had to actually, right, kill a bunch of monsters in order to get gold. And this scarcity, this artificial scarcity, right, because one of the great things about digital goods is, in principle, we can just go into a database and type in an infinite number of zeros behind something, and lo and behold, we generated tons and tons of items. That this principle digital abundance gets turned into scarcity in system, and that's what produces an economy. That makes people then want to trade them, assign value to items, exchange them for real money or for virtual money.
Interesting. So it sounds like games have a fairly extensive history when it comes to having in-game economies. For how long have we been trading items in games like this?
So again, this goes back more or less until the earliest multiplayer online role-playing game. So we're talking the days of days of early EverQuest. So basically, this is now more than 20 years ago. It certainly became super popular and kind of popped into the mind's eye of the public with the launch of the 800-pound gorilla of MMORPGs, World of Warcraft. And because it had such a large public footprint after it came out in 2004 and stirred so much global interest, that was also the game around which then lots of people became aware of the phenomenon that you would pay somebody real money in order to get their avatar or a rare item or their in-game gold.
Or 1,000 gold, right? Yeah. And yeah, and there were at the time, and there still are external companies that essentially that produce gold or level boosting and all these other services for people playing online games.
And more importantly, everything that we're talking about right now as the creator economy, right? So the idea that contemporary online sharing platforms and online content platforms that allow people to create their own content and then that content being traded, again, be that via NFTs or be that around any kinds of games with user-generated content where you can then swap assets that you create. All of that was already prefigured when Second Life launched. And Second Life as a virtual world allowed its own users to create assets and to purchase virtual land and then to trade self-created assets and the land that they would refurbish into different virtual environments. So this is really, in a lot of senses, a second coming of something that people that have been around a little longer just sigh wearily in the same way that when the VR wave happened, everybody who was around long enough waved and said, yeah, this is about the third VR wave that we had. Yeah.
So people could actually buy land in Second Life, like virtual pixel, and build houses there and so forth.
Yep, they did.
So why would someone do that? Like why would you buy a piece of virtual real estate or a virtual Sword of Mayhem plus 5 or a girdle of charisma plus 10 or something? Like what's these are all virtual artifacts. They exist as lines of code. Why would anyone invest hard-earned real money into these? Catherine, any insights?
Well, I mean, I was a big fan of Final Fantasy XI when it came out in the early 2000s, and I can see that, like, I can tell you that there's a lot of people who like to get ahead in the game without perhaps putting in so much work, and so that there were lots of certainly people who would buy wins of various battles with monsters in order to get these particular items. And it was more about in-game kind of credibility, bragging rights, that sort of thing. Because these things are seen as kind of high cachet items, right? So everybody wants them because they help you to win the game more. But in things like Second Life, for example, it's more about things like looking nice. And there's a lot of games that have developed the idea of kind of how you look in games, what your house looks like. There are lots of games that revolve around things like decorations and cosmetic products and making your face look like a butterfly. And I mean, whatever it is that you think might help to make you like feel beautiful or handsome or sexy or whatever in games, and people want to buy that because it for them it's an escape. It's a way for them to kind of perhaps relax in a way. It's also a way for them to show their identity. So there's a lot of people who like to kind of promote, you know, maybe they're furries or something, so they like to dress up like their fursonas, or maybe they have particular ideas of how they look that don't match how they look in real life that they would like to promote. And so these sorts of abilities to be able to do that gives them a lot of satisfaction. And for, you know, just like I might buy a pretty painting to hang on the wall, they might buy a pretty costume to wear in a game. So, you know, it's not so surprising that people want to do this.
That does make sense. I was wondering, so something that has been written, that there's been a lot of writing about in the media in recent years is how some video games have taken on properties that sort of start making them look more like gambling. For example, we've seen a new class of virtual items that you can buy and sell emerge in these virtual economies. I'm of course here referring to loot boxes. David, could you tell us a little bit about the history of loot boxes and what role that they play within game economies right now?
Yeah, sure. So I think there have always been like speculative or random elements to how money is spent in true virtual economies. Like if you think about the people buying stuff in Second Life, you know, people aren't just spending pennies. There are people there spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on virtual goods in the hope that these virtual goods, which are kind of totally unmoored to any real world setting or currency, will have arbitrary value that grows over time. So like, to some extent, the idea of speculation has always been inherent in virtual economies. Lately, a really interesting, though from an economic perspective, quite boring development has happened in virtual economies, which is that developers have realized that actually they hold godlike control over the scarcity of the goods within these domains, right? So you could just leave the little economic system to bubble away on its own and not inject in new things yourself and see what happens. Or you could artificially control the input of new stuff to a virtual environment. So you could create a demand gap for some specific resource within your virtual world, and then you could get players to spend real money getting this scarce resource. And that's one of the things that separate virtual economies from real economies, right? Because it's like having God walking in our midst, but God wants our money. The developers could just create resources. This sort of like, it springs into prominence with microtransactions, right? So like, If we go back maybe 20 years, the idea that you'd buy a game and then I, as a developer, would say, I know you've bought the game, but I'm going to sell you something in that game for an additional $5. If you give me $5, I'll give you some more gold. That would have been unthinkable, controversial. You've bought the game. Why am I spending money for you to shift around the line of code?
True. But now it seems fairly common, right?
Right. It's really widely accepted that we can spend small amounts of money for additional bits of in-game content, additional resources, additional goods within a game. And there are lots of people out there who would say, actually, this is how I support the developers. This is how the developers make a low-cost product. You know, I don't want to spend $50 on this game for my mobile phone. I want to pay nothing for it and then occasionally pay microtransactions when I want to. So this is liberating for me. From an economic perspective, it drives the creation of very strange environments, because you don't want a self-functioning economy, right? You want to deliberately create an in-game world that's broken. And it's only in these dystopias that you can then reach down with your hand of God and give people what they need, be it a resource or a character or a boost or a bonus or extra lives. So this change to virtual economies, where you have a porous layer between real-world money and in-game resource, is causing huge shifts to how games and the economies within games are designed. Like, for my money, I guess it makes them less interesting in many important ways, right? Because it means that you really don't want to create a decentralized, evolutionary, malleable experience in a game or a malleable economy. You want something that you can really quite tightly control as a developer, because that's how you know where the pain points are going to be, where you can sell people things.
That's excellent. Sebastian, any thoughts there?
I think so. What David just was pointing to is the point in the original, that this is about artificial scarcity, right? So this is a system where definitely, where Cotes' law, Lawrence Lessig, the system is completely controlled by the developers. But I think artificial scarcity, in order to shape people's behavior or get money out of their pocket, right, needs to have some value ascribed to it. So somewhere value ascription by the users needs to come in order for that artificial scarcity to be meaningful. And if we go there back to kind of, I don't know, one-on-one economics about the distinction between use value and exchange value, where we say, right, value comes either from the fact that I can use it for something, or it comes from the fact that I can exchange it against something that then has value for me. And then we can say, well, in the majority of kind of early virtual worlds, I would say what we see, so in Second Life or with Swords in World of Warcraft, right, there was, it was chiefly around use value. It was chiefly around, I can use this sword, or I can use this character in order to access content that I couldn't access, or in Second Life, I can use this landscape as my canvas in order to actually create something. So there, money purchasing happened for use value, and I can see in the majority of present virtual economies, particularly, again, in the Web3 sphere of games like Earth 2 or so, we find that they're centered completely around exchange value, right? We don't, there isn't even a game. We just promise that there will be a game in the future where you can use this virtual resource that you can already trade today on the promise that it will have some use value in the future. And that promise alone is enough to turn these virtual items into something that, again, is a pure item of exchange. It's pure exchange value on future hope and promise. And to me, that is kind of, in the long historical view, an interesting shift, that we see that the exchange value as primary concern of virtual items comes to the fore now, kind of in the second coming of virtual economies in the 2020s.
Interesting. So that brings us nicely to the future of virtual economies. It sounds like that what we are seeing now is an early shift from buying items in games that were useful to you playing the game, or someone gave you a way of creatively expressing yourself and your identity, moving over to something that looks a lot more like a stock market, driven by speculation and exchanges of values. David, what should we expect in the next 5-10 years from these virtual economies? Like, what are the trends? Is the use of virtual items as functional things that we use in games, is that going to be outphased completely, and the future will be all exchanges and virtual currencies, NFTs and whatnot? Are we losing the sort of old view on what a virtual item is?
If you look at mobile gaming, for example, the idea of transferring your real money into the in-game environment in return for really substantial game-changing goods and services is common currency. It has been for years, right? Like, the number of mobile games with pay-to-win ecosystems is staggering. Like by far the majority of top grossing mobile games have an economic setup where you can freely transfer funds into the game in order to generate things within that virtual economy. But despite that, we still have other flourishing virtual environments where that's just not the case, right? So this is still a world in which Elden Ring is released and hugely popular. This is still a world in which art games are made. So I think what we'll start to see is a greater differentiation between games, as I think things like NFTs do become common currency and games based around them do. And these will be games in which economic power of the individuals playing the games bears an increasingly important role on their functioning within the virtual environment. And I think we'll see a special class of games emerge in which really important elements of the magic circle that divide the player from the game start to dissolve. I don't think that will pollute or intoxicate the rest of the game's market, though. I think it'll just become even more strongly differentiated than it currently is.
So I think I'd have to probably agree with that. I mean, I don't think we're going to – I mean, there's certainly a lot of hype around NFT-based games and things like that. I think what will be difficult for those is certainly things like balance, and we've already seen that with games like Axie Infinity, where the people who the game economy is set up so that there's a large group of people that just play to earn money, essentially, and then that relies on there being a group of people that are happy to pay to play and buy the goods and services that the people at the who are playing to earn are actually selling. And of course, if that's not balanced well, it can, you know, the bottom can drop out of the market, or and that can really cause problems within the game, not to mention the fact that, you know, there's a whole load of social issues that go along with the differentiating factors between the two groups of people that are playing this game. And I think that this is actually a really interesting example of sort of early NFT-based systems that are, you know, making a lot of mistakes, and perhaps the later ones will learn from that. But I think for me, the biggest thing is this sort of hype around potential playing to earn items and then using those across multiple games. And I am a little bit more skeptical about that. I mean, for one, it's already available. Like, you see crossovers in games all the time. So Monster Hunter is a really good example of where other games, you know, use the asset, like they basically sign some IP arrangement and then they transfer assets across, and you can run around Monster Hunter dressed like Geralt from The Witcher, for example, right? And so that already kind of exists. But what a lot of these sort of hype NFT hype people sort of get excited about is the idea of functional items being able to be transferred between games, and that requires a lot of organization from both the studios who are developing the games, because I mean, what if one asset is in like Unity and the other one's in like Unreal or something like that? I mean, it's not something that will just happen by magic, and so there needs to be a lot of things behind the scenes going on to actually set that up to work, and I'm kind of skeptical about that.
So I would, oh, sorry, Sebastian.
If I can jump in there, so the whole play to earn thing for me is fascinating from a psychological point of view, because I think what that aspect overlooks, so whenever people talking about, well, just playing for its own sake is super inefficient, so in the future you will every hour played will actually earn you some revenue, overlooks that, right, one of the main reasons we play is the experience of autonomy and freedom and self-determination we get out of playing by doing it for its own sake, right? By engaging in beautiful waste, by it being a waste of time that I chose to waste my time on. And the second that I turn that into remunerated activity or mandated activity, then suddenly a lot of that fun in play disappears. Like, this is basically Tom Sawyer's whitewashing the fence, right? When Aunt Polly mandates that he whitewash, it's a chore. But when he says, no, I do this for its own sake, then others even play him for the privilege of doing the labor of whitewashing the fence for him. So I think there's this interesting psychological dynamic that people very often overlook in the whole play to earn discourse. And I think that plays into what David said previously, into a kind of differentiation. So I definitely think in the next years we're going to see a gold rush, and with a gold rush, we're in the middle of a gold rush. There's going to be hypes, there's going to be bubbles, there's going to be crashes. Regulation will follow in its wake. That's always been the case with gold rushes. And after regulation follows consolidation, because new regulation usually creates barriers to entry. And as a result, we see a couple of big companies who can basically pay up for the due diligence for the new regulations. And then we're going to see a differentiation in the market between, okay, here are a couple of games that give you your play for play sake, beautiful magic circle, waste of time experience. And then there will be a couple of few very differentiated games that say, no, you're in this for the trading. You're in this for this new form of playing and gaming as economic exchange and trading. That will be its own interesting new weird subset of games that will pop up that, again, will live in a new kind of regulatory bubble, I think.
So I was wondering, so recently in movies and books and lots of company pitches, we've been promoting this idea of the metaverse, and I can perhaps refer here to the to the movie Ready Player One, where apart from the dystopian real world that these people live in, the virtual universe seems to be like this beautiful hub with activities and stuff that you can do. You can play games, you earn some gold, use that gold elsewhere, you migrate assets in between games. It all seems very happy and positive and optimistic. But I'm starting to wonder, from hearing what all of you are saying, is this a good vision? Like, is this where we want to end up, or is this vision basically just a sort of a capitalist nightmare where the wealthy stay wealthy and buy all the assets, give scholarships to lower ranked players so they can pay to earn? Like, what's the vision that we should create here? Like, where do we want to end up? Sorry, Catherine.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, I think there's certainly things that we can encourage companies that want to embark on these sorts of like, I mean, there's a lot of, I think to a certain degree it will be a little bit of a capitalistic nightmare for a while because of this gold rush kind of situation where there's sort of, you know, the hyper-capitalistic approach is kind of applied to as many things as possible, and we'll see which ones work and which ones don't work and all of that. And I mean, I think sort of some of the lessons that might come out of that is the obviously not just about what works and what doesn't work, but what is actually hopefully beneficial to society as opposed to detrimental to society. And I mean, I guess as an ethicist, I'm kind of interested in the delineation between those things and what is it that we want to look out for. And I think sort of if you're a company that's wanting to go into this and you want to kind of get a bit of a head start on some of these lessons, perhaps, you know, some of the things you should be thinking about are things like, how do we make sure that there aren't kind of a two-tier situation for the players of our games, where we have, like, especially players from, say, lower economic backgrounds, like, you know, the Philippines, Philippines and Venezuela apparently are big players of Axie Infinity in the play to earn side of things, but it tends to be kind of, you know, white middle class Westerners who are in the pay to play type situation in these sorts of games. So that's obviously a big socioeconomic discriminator, and that sort of equality, you know, given that it's built that inequality that's built into the game directly, that's something that needs to be kind of, you know, if you want to have a game that is actually like, not just, like, I guess you want it to for people to earn stuff, but you want everybody to have a fair shot at it, right? So that fairness side of things, I mean, it's a hard problem, but I mean, it's one perhaps that you'd like, you know, you'd want to have a focus on. I mean, also things like, I mean, the fact that we've already got a really, really vibrant creator economy, and that's actually a place where there's a lot of really good stuff happening. If you can kind of harness that and allow creators to kind of keep some of the revenue from the things that they're selling through these situations, then that's actually, you know, another avenue for artistic people who might not necessarily get so much of the revenue in you know, a digital environment where everything's easy to copy and paste. But, you know, obviously there are sort of some social side problems that come with that as well. So it's all about balancing out these scenarios, and then looking at which technology is the most appropriate to use for that. And it might not be the latest, greatest NFT, bloody blah, blockchain stuff. It might actually just be, you know, sitting down and organizing your economy so that those sorts of values are promoted within that.
Those are very interesting perspectives. I almost feel a little bit like games have been losing an innocence that we might ascribe them normally. Games being this fun, delightful activity, playfulness, and that one of the things that we may seek to protect in the future is that element is still preserved. So we don't end up in a situation where gaming is suddenly all about revenue and money, also for the players. David, do you have any thoughts on sort of what kind of future virtual economies that we should strive for, and some advice for creators and developers?
So I think we're at a really interesting moment, a really ambitious moment, where a number of different countries are jockeying to kind of control the future of virtual economies through this idea of metaversal economies, where all the different sort of specific universes of different games or products are linked together into one gigantic overarching universe. And I think we have to think very carefully about who controls the substrate of reality underneath this metaverse. When you control the very nature of being, you have enormous power that you don't have in the real world, right? So in the real world, if Meta wanted to look inside my house, overhear a conversation I'm having with my wife, use that to sell specific goods and services to me, or indeed look inside my bank balance and then work out, oh, he's in debt or he's not in debt, this is exactly how much he can afford his paycheck. They can't do that because reality puts barriers in the way, right? They'd have to, like Mark Zuckerberg would have to break into my bins and like go through the paperwork in my bins, or he'd have to be sort of hiding under my stairs or something, or plant a bug in my house.
Well, yeah, fair.
In the metaverse, companies will have complete control over how reality functions. And that could be a utopian dream, or it could be a dystopic nightmare, depending on the companies that we allow to control this future.
Very interesting. Yeah, I completely agree with you there. We are running out of time. This has been incredibly interesting, and there is definitely heaps more to dive into from this early conversation about the future of virtual economies, and we will definitely be exploring this more in the future. To our listeners, thank you for listening in today. We hope it was enjoyable and informative, and we'll be back with future episodes and hopefully a higher production value as well. All the best to everyone, and thank you.